Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Dunker Spot. We are part of 342 Productions. I am your host, Nikias Duncan, and joining me as always is my co-host, Steve Jones Jr. Steve, how are you doing, sir?
Aha, feeling good, feeling great, happy to be here, excited to be here. Thank you, Dunkers, for once again embracing your bounce. Dunker Nation, let's ride. YouTube, hi, hello, hit that like button. There's nobody like y'all. Appreciate the support. But Nikias, it is time to hoop it up.
It is time to hoop it up indeed. Second round of the playoffs are here. W preseason things are here. We'll try to get to that towards the end of the podcast. I am ready to dig in to a couple of more series. We had some game six with the Clippers and the Mavs that ended. So we officially have Luka versus Shea and all the things. We're going to talk about that series. We get Celtics Cavs as the result of the game seven we got between the Magic and the Cavaliers on Sunday. Going to have some fun with that one. One of the, I guess, tougher things about recording on Mondays, we do have Knicks Pacers happening tonight. Not going to get to talk about the game one. We will talk about that on the next episode of the pod. But if you do want our Knicks Pacers thoughts, one, we did 30 plus minutes of a full blown preview on the last episode of Dunker Spot. So check that out and subscribe if you haven't already. We'd appreciate it. But if you want shorter thoughts, quicker thoughts heading into the series, we were on the Old Man, the Three Things with JJ Redick. We talked about Knicks Pacers there, so you can at least get some of our thoughts there. And again, as the series goes on, and more specifically the next episode, we'll be digging into game one and talking about the series moving forward. So there's your Knicks Pacers thing. Before we dig into playoff series previews and the game one between the Wolves and the Nuggets, quick news update on the award front. As we record on this Monday afternoon, Rookie of the Year is going to be announced tonight. I think it is fair to assume that Victor Wembanyama is going to be your Rookie of the Year. So, Steve, just a question for you. There are 99 ballots. We do not have one, but 99 award ballots. Does Victor Wembanyama receive more than 96 first place votes?
Yes.
Okay. Do you think he'll end up being unanimous?
This very much feels like no. I feel like there's going to be a person. And social media will explode trying to figure out who did it.
Ah, I see. Which, it's funny because like they don't have to, considering the ballots are just released after everything is announced. So like you can't just wait a couple weeks and see who did it. Or that person may step up. But I just had fun thinking about that earlier because I was like, I don't think Wemby's going to be unanimous. Like, I think he's going to win. He's more than deserving, obviously. In the second half of the year in particular just kind of sealed the case for him. But I do wonder how many of the efficiency plus impact on a winner votes Chet gets, which would also be deserved. Like, understand why he would have a case. But I don't know if Wemby ends up being unanimous. So I'm curious to see like how that rolls out once that rolls through. Later tonight, Defensive Player of the Year being announced on Tuesday, and the big boy, MVP, being announced on Wednesday. Cannot wait to see what the conversation is going to be like there. We'll be talking about that on the pod on Thursday. But there's your award update. Let's get into a couple of series previews. The Boston Celtics, the Cleveland Cavaliers. We don't know what the status is of Jared Allen with the rib or Kristaps Porzingis with the soleus strain. Not sure if either of those two are going to make an appearance in this series or when. But those are your primary injuries there. Also, Dean Wade, we'll keep an eye on him as well. During the regular season series, Boston won that series 2-1. The one win was the Dean Wade game in which he just lost his mind from three. That was the February matchup. But in typical fashion, of the three games, two of those played in December. And the third one, February 10th. So it's been a while since these two teams have matched up. They look a little differently. They're playing a little bit differently. Heading into this one, like, I'm intrigued. One, I kind of feel for Donovan Mitchell. Incredible close to the series against the Orlando Magic. Fun duel with him and Jalen Suggs and just the collective size and length that the Orlando Magic have. You go from Jalen Suggs to now having to deal with some combination of Jrue Holiday, Derek White. I'm sure he'll see at least some Jaylen Brown. He'll see some Jason Tatum on switches. Life of a number one option isn't easy. Seems like a tough start for your first two rounds of the playoffs, but I am excited to see what that duel is going to look like. But parsing through some of the regular season matchups between those two and how Cleveland wanted to match up, no Evan Mobley in two of the matchups, so that made it a little bit tricky. I wonder who Cleveland's going to start in this series. Because as we saw in the game seven With no Jared Allen, we had Evan Mobley at the five. Isaac Okoro slotted into the starting lineup. He was kind of your nominal four there. I was intrigued looking back at the December matchups and seeing how Jared Allen and Evan Mobley were deployed in terms of the matchups. We saw some Mobley on Jaylen Brown. We saw a lot of Jared Allen against Jason Tatum, most of that coming on switches. But there were a handful of possessions where Jared Allen just had the Tatum matchup. And I was like, wait a minute, that is interesting. And I think I cited throughout the regular season, we were talking about all defense things. I think Jared Allen defended the most ISOs in the league this year. So wouldn't be a surprise if they continue to switch. They did switch a bunch against Boston this year. I wonder if they go with Okoro just to get a little bit more perimeter defense, or if they want to size up at all. Do we see Marcus Morris as that fifth starter?
Do we see Marcus Morris in this series? Yes. Do we see Marcus Morris starting? I'm not sure. In my head, I'm thinking because of the potential comfort level of putting Strus on Jaylen Brown, or even Strus on Jason Tatum, I'm even more the level of having Okoro on one of those two, likely Tatum, you probably go with those two plus your guards plus Evan Mobley. But the Jared Allen aspect of it does make it very interesting. The Porzingis aspect of it does make it very interesting because Cleveland, again, is a different team when they have two bigs and they can shuffle through the lineups where they only have one. Boston still has Al Horford, who obviously we know can do a bunch of things on both ends of the floor to help this team. But then behind that, it does get a little regular with the big man room. You know, they have options, but that's going to be drop, and that's going to be more of a role than a pick and pop role threat like Kristaps Porzingis. So how does that impact some of your lineup construction? Does that give Cleveland an opportunity? Like I'm intrigued by that portion of it. Because I mean, if Luke Kornet's going to play, could Tristan Thompson now have soak up some more minutes, et cetera, some stuff like that. So it's tough to get a good feel on that part of it. Cause if Jared Allen's going to be available for game one, well, that's a different Cleveland team. And now Boston's got a couple other things they got to think about or worry about. Rebounds. You got extra help and protection in the rim. If not, and now it's a smaller version of Cleveland, how much does that help Boston do the things that they want to do?
It makes sense. And I'm glad you brought up just the level of comfort that Cleveland has had giving Strus the Tatum matchup. We saw that in some of the December games between the two. But that's where my mind started churning because I was just like, do they want, I guess it really just boils down to how they want to deploy Evan Mobley and where they see his value being best utilized. But I think we've seen in that Orlando series in particular, if he's just on non-shooter or is just able to be closer to the rim, he's going to have an obvious impact as a deterrent and just as a shot contester at the basket. Also, it was a lot of Evan Mobley against Paolo Banchero in that first round series. And Evan Mobley did one heck of a job throughout the course of that series. And because of his versatility, because of the length, because of his ability to mirror in space, I wonder if J.B. Bickerstaff looks at it and say, you know what, I might just prioritize having him on one of Jaylen or Jason to start. Let's see if we can bother them with the length. We can turn a lot of these ball screens into switches anyway because Mobley is comfortable switching everywhere. And that's where the Mobley piece came in my head. Put Marcus Morris on Al Horford so you could at least have an element of size there versus like Okoro can do it. Like even looking at some of the, you know, the ball screens or the handoffs or whatever with Kristaps Porzingis, like Cleveland was very comfortable switching that. You would have a Strus on Porzingis or a Okoro on Porzingis. So they're comfortable switching smalls onto them. I just wondered if JB would prioritize the size element of that and then kind of move Evan Mobley around the chessboard.
I think it's a fair point. That I wonder if that's a let's swing for the fences in game one or that's something let's try and see if we can get to it over the course of a game one. How do you feel about Boston's offense in this series?
This feels like a we have to be on it series for Boston in terms of their tempo. Because Cleveland has shown such a comfort to switch, they have to hammer the matches that they have, which is going to be a pretty important series for the Cleveland guards, Darius Garland in particular. Since he has pretty consistently been a show and recover guy against Boston. And generally, you don't want to feed Boston two on the ball, but they just haven't shown the comfort of switching Garland out onto a Jaylen or onto a Jason. But I feel like there's going to be driving room for Boston in this one, particularly if they're able to move Evan Mobley around. Like, part of that's just going to be the matchup portion and who Cleveland has in their starting group. But beyond that, something that you pointed out during the game seven, as Paolo was starting to find a little bit more comfort in the first half, Cleveland was, I mean, Orlando was pretty intentional about making sure Evan Mobley's just in the strong side corner. Let's keep you over there. Let's just play 4-on-4 over here, or let's clear a wing on the opposite side. Let's have some fun. Let's get my guys downhill. Boston can also do that with much better offensive talent overall than Orlando does. And so I wonder how much of that game plan they just kind of create from Orlando and say, you know, we got drivers all over the place. If we can stash Evan Mobley over here, even if they put, if they do go more traditional, they just have Mobley on Al Horford. All right, cool. Let's just put Al Horford on the right corner. Jason Tatum, you can do your thing. Jaylen Brown is one pass away, or you can flip that. And they can just have all of the fun without Evan Mobley having as much impact at the rim as he would like. So they have options. They obviously have talent. I do think Temple's going to be a big deal because Cleveland's going to work to bog them down. I do believe they're still going to be a switch-heavy group against Boston. If they can nail the Temple portion of it, they should be able to get downhill. They should be able to put a lot of pressure on Cleveland.
I think it's going to be interesting when you look at both teams coming off the series they had. I'm glad you mentioned the tempo, because for me with Boston, what does the tempo look like for them in this series? How do they balance some of what they want to do? How do they balance the off-ball movement that they have with making quick decisions in the half court or in transition with the drives? I think the drives are going to be important from Jason Tatum, from Jaylen Brown, from Derek White, from Jrue Holiday. Can they get to drive and kick? How much do they want to mix in attacking matchups and where are they getting the catches, especially for Tatum or Brown? And how does Cleveland react to that? I'm interested to see how does Cleveland's defense hold up? Because they have a high level of activity. We've mentioned the bigs and what they can do. They were able to show a lot of help against Orlando. But even in that series, they had issues getting clean coverages at times when Paolo was a screener or when Paolo was a ball handler. And so can they stay consistent with that show and recover when they do want to go with the switch or a late switch? Can they nail that portion of it? Because Boston's a little bit different in the sense that they're going to get a lot of threes up and they can generate the kind of threes they want to. And so if you're not clean in those coverages and now you have to send a different kind of help than you want to, you're in rotation. Boston can just go ahead and get to drive and kick. They can get the kind of shots they want. And you're in a scenario where instead of it just being, oh, that's Jonathan Isaac in the corner, it might be, oh, that's Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown together on the same side. And now we're trying to rotate and recover to that. Or, you know, two on the ball on accident because, you know, we don't want to switch Garland onto Tatum. Now he's able to get downhill and cause chaos. I think that's where Cleveland just has to be really clean. And Boston has to work to make sure they keep that pressure on them. You know, this could be a Jrue Holiday post-up series. This could be a Derek White early offense series. It's just which buttons is Boston going to touch? Because if Cleveland can bog them down, if Cleveland can, you know, be comfortable with a drop and navigate and recover, mix in some switches as the game goes on, lineups change. If they could just kind of move it around to where Boston is just playing a little bit slower, the ball's a little stickier. It's a lot more threes. The drives aren't as impactful. Now you get into the fourth quarter and we started saying, hey, where's the tempo, Boston? What happened?
It's funny that we're having like the tempo question with Boston, considering Cleveland has long been the tempo team in the East on this podcast. So Cleveland's going to have to be on it as well. I do have a Boston related question for you before I flip to the other side. With Jason Tatum, how do you think Boston goes about opening him up? Because if you just look at the regular season matchup, he did average 26 against Cleveland this year, 41% on twos, well below his average. Shot about 36% from three, 10 assists to 9 turnovers during those three games. How much of it is do better button for Tatum versus is there anything from when you went back and watched some stuff? Was there anything that you feel like Boston could get to more to generate some easier looks for Jason Tatum?
It's one of those things where I feel like his drives were important. His drives drew free throws. And then it was a lot of, hey, potentially matchup hunt. And then, hey, we need you in doses, if that makes sense. Because if you have a night where Jaylen Brown's able to feel like he can go at Max Strus and drive and attack, and Derek White's able to be balanced and attack, it just didn't feel like they leaned on Tatum to the same degree. So I thought it was just different in that way. Does that make sense?
Yeah, so more of like a rhythm deal for Tatum.
Yeah. And so instead of it, this is the Tatum package, it was more Tatum playing out of the flow. And I wonder how much that shifts with how Boston, especially how Boston attacked Miami. So I anticipate we'll see more of Tatum and more of Tatum getting the matchups he wants and getting the catches he wants. But I mean, I would just say probably he's got to continue to force the issue and drive. He's got to be someone who's really good in transition in this series. I think if he can get some easy ones, including getting to the foul line, then the rest should probably take care of itself.
Okay. I figured I'd ask you on that front. And like now, as I still just have like Orlando Cleveland things in my head, I'm thinking about how Boston utilizes Jason Tatum as a screener. Both for just more like traditional pick and rolls high up on the floor, but also just the mismatch hunt for him. We saw a lot of those free throw line area catches for Paolo in the game seven and sprinkled in throughout the series as well. If you do have a Derek White being defended by Donovan or by Darius Garland, could be a way to get that switch and get those lower catches, as you kind of alluded to, would make the drives from Jason Tatum more impactful, will make some of those mid-range jumpers a lot more easier for him, more within his wheelhouse with some of those face-ups and just some of those isolations in general. But like in terms of usage, I'm probably with you. Like nothing really popped for me in terms of where is this part of the Tatum package. I will say, you know, you already mentioned the drive is going to be important. Curious to see just, again, how Boston spaces out around the Tatum drives and how they look to move Evan Mobley around, because I think that's going to play a big impact on how effective Tatum's going to be getting downhill. And that kind of blends into just the general shot creation for Boston and the shot profile and getting a bunch of threes up. On the Cleveland front.
Oh,
go ahead.
One thing that stood out to me, I was just thinking as you were saying, if they're using Jason Tatum as a ball handler and trying to put Garland in action, it can lend itself to Cleveland goes show and recover. Cleveland goes under. Tatum takes that three. And so if he's just missing that, it just looks a different way. So I wanted to throw that out there because it's just, I wonder if that is part of the issue usage-wise.
No, that's fair. That's fair. And then also just thinking about those positions now, like a lot of rejects in the regular season series for Tatum and ball screens there. So we'll see just what his general approach is going to be. On the Cleveland front, again, we don't know when Porzingis comes back, if he does come back in round two. It's going to be Horford. I imagine they will switch him. Sometimes it would probably be primarily a drop, if I had to guess. Kornet's going to be in the drop. Xavier Tillman, if he gets dusted off, like I think that's where more of the scheme versatility can pop with him, with some of those bench units. Cleveland's guards are going to have to ding the drop. They're going to have to ding the drop. This is going to have to be an aggressive Darius Garland series. I don't think I need to say Donovan Mitchell needs to be aggressive. I think he's just going to be aggressive. But if Donovan Mitchell has the pull-up going to a degree that he didn't really have for most of the first-round series against Orlando, like that's kind of the wilder part about how good Donovan Mitchell was. He got to his spots. He put an incredible amount of strain on Orlando's defense without really having a pull-up game. Like the closest we got was like a pull-up quarter. And he just made timely shots. There is some room for him to just be lights out with some of these deeper pull-ups. So if he's able to ding those, can you get an Al Horford to creep higher up? Maybe it's not a switch. Maybe we just get two on the ball. Let's get the ball out of your hands. Let's see what Evan Mobley does on the short roll, if he's going to be your primary screener. Donovan Mitchell and Darius Garland both have the ability to force Boston's hands, to that matter. Or at the very least, force them to play with their matchups so we can turn more of these into switches. So it's going to be very important for them. Like, very dull analysis there, so my apologies. But those are going to be the pockets that those two in particular have. And so we will see if they're able to handle their home. But how do you feel about those guards coming into this matchup?
Well, first of all, it's not duh analysis. Someone's got to talk about it because a lot of people are not like us, Nikias. The one thing I will say is that Donovan Mitchell, Darius Garland, big keys to the Cleveland Cavaliers offense. And I think particularly with how Boston should guard them in theory, can you attack the space? Can you score and make plays? Can you deal with the defenders trying to take you away? Can you open up things for Evan Mobley on the short roll even at the beginning? We haven't had the Donovan Mitchell pull-up game. Darius Garland, while he worked to find it in the Orlando series, it's been an adventure sometimes for him as far as the timing of when to attack, the aggression, balancing, making plays in space versus looking to score. Those two just have to have the mindset to attack. And I, in my mind, I'm wondering, even though you go from a series, as you mentioned earlier, with the type of defenders Orlando had, and now you have to deal with Jrue Holiday, Derek White, do they feel free in this series? Is there an element of, hey, this isn't the same size and length? Screen navigation is going to be the exact same, but this isn't the same size and length. That drop is a little deeper than Wendell Carter Jr. kind of moving with me and stunning at my drive. Is there an element of we get a mix of what we do on ball and off ball? You know, as I think that's one thing that Cleveland, with even their tempo questions or their offense questions, they are, when they are humming, they are running good sets. They are moving the ball. They're moving their bodies. Can they open themselves up that way to where now it's handoffs for Garland or Mitchell and they turn the corner, or it's staggers and they're involved in different actions and they go from side to side? Like, that's where I feel like, can Cleveland find something against Boston that maybe they didn't have in that slugfest against Orlando, where, you know, terms are being dictated every single game, every game's different. And it's not necessarily that Boston's not an elite level defense. They're just a little bit different. So it's, can Cleveland open things up that way? You know?
Yeah. Like, the, it's weird to say lack of size because Boston is not a small group at all. Mm-hmm. But to your point, like, they are just generally a smaller group than Orlando is. And just that extra bit of space could lead to more comfort for Darius Garland as he, because I think one of the things that popped during the Orlando series, and you alluded to it, it's Wendell in a drop, but okay, how much room do I really have to navigate this? Because with Wendell being in a drop, but still being closer to Garland or whoever the ball handler is, it's like the illusion of having to be engaged, but not really being engaged because he hasn't really made a decision yet. This is just where I am, and you have to navigate that space. And with Al Horford, he has the ability to do that. Like, we've made the joke on the pod over the past few years. The playoffs come, the knees get warm, and now Al just does whatever you need him to do. He just turns into all-star Al Horford during the postseason. So it's not like he can't do that. But to your point, like, I do think the drop's going to be a little bit deeper for him than what you saw from Wendell. It'll probably be closer to the Mo Wagner drop that we saw in those reps. And so with that, and because you don't have, you know, Paolo isn't an A-plus defender, but if Paolo's at the nail or defending someone at the wing, him reaching is a little bit different than Jaylen Brown. Brown's a better defender, but just in terms of size and length, that's a little bit different. Do you get more comfort for Darius Garland? Do we see the return of the floater in earnest? And now do we get the floater turning into the lob now when you get the late commit? And again, if you get the best version of Darius Garland, it opens some things up for you. Because the exciting part about this Cleveland roster overall is that we have two guards that can just break your game plan no matter what you do. If Darius Garland gets going, there isn't a comfortable coverage for him. You can put two on the ball against him, but he's such a good passer. He's one of the best passers in the sport. That's putting your defense in rotation. Boston has personnel to to counter that. But in general, you're in rotation. Donovan Mitchell, deep pull-ups, regular pull-up threes, pull-up twos. We get to the floater. We get into the windmill. Gathers getting downhill. He's getting to the free throw line. They have this kind of game-breaking ability. So I'm excited to see what it looks like for them. And in general, again, to your point, Orlando wants to play slow and wants to control possessions. Boston just plays faster than Orlando does, which even if Cleveland tries to slow things down, it's still going to be a faster game than what they just had to deal with, which could lead to more of that freedom. I want to see how Boston treats Max Strus in this series. I want to see who gets the Strus assignment, honestly. Because that feels like one where you come into the series just expecting they have Darius Garland, Donovan Mitchell. We have Jrue Holiday and Derek White. We're just going to do that. I would not be surprised at all if we come into game one, and maybe it's just a game one thing, but it's, you know what? Jaylen Brown, you take Donovan Mitchell. You've taken on tough guard assignments throughout the year. You take him. Derek White, we want you navigating, or Jrue Holiday, we want you navigating against Darius Garland. Derek White, you hound Max Strus. We want to try to take this movement element off the table for Cleveland. Because what we don't want to happen is for Garland to see drop, Mitchell to see drop, and now they're also going into their stagger stuff or some of their elbow action, and they have Max Strus flying off, and he's seeing openings too. Let's take this off the board. Let's allocate one of our best perimeter defenders that you think we're putting on Gardner Mitchell. Let's put him on Strus. Make sure he doesn't get off. Let's see what this offense looks like with 13 on the clock and under.
Well, they did it. So I wouldn't be surprised. I think there is a switchability aspect to it, if that makes sense, to where they're going to end up cross-matched on in different scenarios. So I'm with you on that. I would not be surprised to see Derek White on Strus to take that movement off the table. Put Drew on Garland. You put Jaylen Brown on Mitchell, as you stated. What gets interesting is, do you go all the way and do you just put Jason Tatum on Evan Mobley and say, Al Horford, you guard starter X. Let's just say Okoro, for example. Or do they keep that in the tuck? I am curious about that. But I think no doubt about it, it's a big Strus series. Spoiling my X factor. We'll go to it in a second. But back to something you said earlier, real quick. You mentioned, can they get Boston to go two on the ball, right? Mm-hmm. Is Boston's first answer just going to be, hey, let's switch this stuff? Let's take away Evan Mobley as a roller. Let's take away some of the reads they have.
Probably, honestly. Like, I would at least make Evan prove it first. Because, again, I think that's going to be more of a, how much are these guards cooking? And if they're not cooking, we can afford to just kind of keep this flat. And if Evan Mobley is able to hit three jump hooks in a row or three push shots in a row, or if he's able to get to the free throw line, which a quick hat tip to Evan Mobley, if you just look at his offensive numbers from the first round series, didn't feel like he had a big offensive series. I really enjoyed his process in the first round. Like, I really thought he absorbed contact. He sought out contact with some of those opportunities. I don't feel the way that I felt in that Knicks series last year. Obviously, shots have to fall because it's the playoffs and you want to win and you need efficiency. But I don't think Mobley's going to be afraid to try to win against those size mismatches. So maybe he scores enough to take that off the board. Maybe, you know, to the overall point about Cleveland feeling more comfortable, maybe that's going to be an element of it. Okay, Paolo isn't an elite defender, but Paolo is almost as tall as I am and he's super strong. Hey, wait a minute. I'm taking this jump hook over Jaylen Brown, who's also strong, but he's not Paolo strong. He's also not Paolo tall. Does that make it a little bit different? Like, finding those windows could open up some things for Cleveland. But as you were, you know, hinting at X factors, who are your X factors for the series, good sir?
Max Strus for Cleveland. He did shoot 40% for three against Boston on 7.5 attempts during the regular season. They need his shot making. That they need to be able to use him in movement sets. They need to be able to space him in different places, whether it's on the wing so they can go empty corner or in the corner so that they can try and hold a rotation. He's going to have to toss in a couple plays off the bounce, whether it's the pull up or turn the corner, see if I can get something going, keep us going. And he has to hold up defensively for Cleveland in this series. So I probably point to Max Strus there. For Boston, I'm going to go Drew Holiday. This feels like a Drew series as far as the impact he can have. Obviously, the defense speaks for itself with what he could do, not just against Garland and Mitchell, but multiple positions if they need it, if they want to go switching. Offensively, this feels where, hey, if Cleveland's going to be in rotation, can Drew go ahead and knock down some of those open shots? Can Drew be someone who posts Garland or Mitchell? Can you get value out of Drew operating in pick and roll? Or being a screener, and now those scenarios where Cleveland's not as clean and they put two on the ball, can Drew now roll and play make on the short roll and open things up for Boston that way? I'd probably lean Drew in this series.
Okay. I think for me, X factor number one is just going to be health. X factor number two is probably just the Cleveland backcourt. But to the harder question, I start with Isaac Okoro with the Cavs. Because whether he starts or not, the defense obviously is going to be important. He will spend time on Jason Tatum. He will probably spend some time on Jaylen Brown, depending on what the lineups are. He's going to have to do his best to take those two as much off the table as you can with wings that talented and with the spacing that Tatum and Brown will see just because of the talent level that they have. But if he's able to make it tough on them, force a couple of turnovers, or just play a part in bogging down Boston's offense with his navigation and even with his help, I think Quiet Skip, he is a really good help defender as well. And obviously, that can have an impact. And offensively, he's going to be a help point for Boston. You mentioned Boston having the ability to kind of play with the matchups. I wouldn't be surprised at all if we see Al Horford on Isaac Okoro. so you'd be closer to the rim, or just to dare Cleveland to use Okoro as a screener and see what they can get out of it. Okoro's going to have to be up for the challenge. If he is spaced in the corner, knock down enough shots, attack enough, drive enough closeouts, and either finish or keep things moving, keep Boston in rotation, he's going to play a pretty big role in the series. And then for Boston, it's going to be Al Horford for me. How well will he hold up on switches? How sturdy will it be in the drop? If he does have to creep up to the level purely, hedge out or trap, what does that look like? Will he make and take enough shots when he's spaced on the offensive end? What is the blend of shot taking from the perimeter versus let me float to this handoff or a quick pitch and we flow into a pick and roll from there? Just what is his general aggression going to look like there? I think if he's able to hold serve, one, that helps Boston win. Two, if Al Horford is playoff Al Horford, you can probably slow play to Kristaps' recovery. And so maybe if he may be ready for like a game five or a game six, but because Al is playing so well, let's just wait until the Eastern Conference Finals and give you all the room to get well. Just because Al Horford is playing this well and we're getting enough from Cornette, Xavier Tillman, however they want to downsize when Horford's on the bench. So keeping an eye on those two in particular. Steve, who do you have in the series?
I think this is going to be a fun one. I'm sure many people are writing Cleveland off. I would just note this is a team that works hard, is prideful. They earn their spot here. They're probably going to have something to prove and they're going to feel like they're the underdog. The game one fascinates me as we head into watching it. When you see this, it'll be tonight, but it feels like a wide array. Like it could be Cleveland is just behind prep wise and rest wise. And now all of a sudden Boston runs away with game one, or Cleveland is sneaking into a back and forth. And now you got to deal with them. I'm going to go with Boston in six. And it's mainly because I don't know the availability of Jared Allen. And so if there's no Jared Allen, how many lineups do you truly have? How many lineups do you have that can deal with Boston, even as they shorten their bench? Can you hold up on both ends? It could, I'm surprised you didn't say it, it could just be a math battle once you get to a certain point as far as three-pointers go. I think Cleveland's going to fight. I'm going to take Boston six.
Okay, makes sense. And I love that you framed it the way that you did. That gives me the opportunity to empty out one of the notes that I was about to leave in the notepad here. As I had some Boston, just some general Boston stuff up to see how they fared against Cleveland versus their overall regular season numbers, all coming from Clean the Glass. A 118.2 offensive rating against Cleveland, that's 5 points worse than their regular season mark. An offensive rating in the half court of 100, which is 6.5 points worse than the regular season mark. But as we talk about the absence of Jared Allen, how good of a player he is, specifically how good of a rebounder he is, in the regular season matchups with these two, Boston with a 32.7 offensive rebound rate in those three matchups, which would be the equivalent of the second best team in the league. And during the regular season, they ranked 11th. In addition to the three-point math, it could just be possession battle for Boston if they're able to generate some extra opportunities, with Jared Allen being out of there. And that's also where it becomes important and where I'm curious to see how Boston looks to move Evan Mobley around. Because if they are able to avoid him and his rim protection, that's one thing in and of itself. But even if they get to the rim where they, you know, draw help, kick out for a three, now Mobley's trying to crash down from the corner to clear out of possession. Boston can get some extra chances there. And they have guards, Drew Holiday, Derek White, Peyton Pritchard when he's in. They are not afraid to kind of fly in and get extra opportunities there. So that could be another feather in the cap for Boston. I'm probably closer to Boston in five than Boston in six, just because of the health element for Boston, for Cleveland. I think the Allen impact is a little bit heavy, weighs a little bit heavier on Cleveland than the Kristaps absence, just because, I mean, they still have Al Horford at the end of the day. Cleveland really had to work against Orlando. Like, that's just a lot of wear and tear. And Boston is just a better team. And so I think it's going to be a hard-fought five. Like, we may see a blowout in this series, but I do think everything is going to be relatively close. But I would probably lean Boston in five right now. Any closing thoughts, questions before we move to Thunder Mavericks?
No, other than a very dunker spot to go half an hour on Boston-Cleveland with Luka versus Shea right here.
Yeah, that's what we do. I hear no one's talking about Boston, so we had to make sure that we gave Boston their due in the segment. Anyway, we have Thunder Mavericks. The Thunder won the regular season matchup 3-1, though. Matchup on December the 2nd. This is before both teams made trades. Got a matchup on February the 10th, in which Dallas just blew OKC out the water. We had no Luka on the March 14th matchup. And on the April 14th matchup, I think Dallas just didn't have anyone playing in terms of their reign rotation. And we got, what, like 10 minutes of Shea? It was very much a we'll play y'all in the first quarter, and then we're just emptying the bench at this point. So not a ton to glean from the regular season matchups in particular. Worth noting, Maxi Kleber with his right shoulder injury, he's out indefinitely. And also a quick hat tip to Jason Kidd, who signed a multi-year extension. I think a first-round win over the Clippers probably helps in that regard. But we do have Shea versus Luka. And beyond all the narrative things, which I'm sure there's going to be plenty of room for other people to do that. I don't really want to dig too deep into that. These are two of like the six best players in basketball. Both are really fun drivers. Both just put incredible strain on defenses. And so much of the series is going to revolve around how is OKC planning to match up with Dallas? And what exactly does Dallas want to do against Shea? So I think naturally the series does start there. And more so, I'm curious to see how OKC wants to deal with Luka. We know Luka can throw any scheme that you toss at him over the top rope. I do wonder how much size is going to play into this one. Because while Lu Dort is a tremendous defender, and he is feisty on ball, and he is one of the best screen navigators in the sport, he has a cool sense of when to fight over and try to stay attached and when to slide under and meet you on the other side and still do so with a level of physicality that you don't feel comfortable trying to drive against him anyway. It's still Luka versus like a 6'3 or 6'4 dude. And more so than the pick and rolls, I wonder what the clear side ISOs or what the post-ups are going to look like with Luka. OKC has been a very aggressive double team team throughout the year. Dallas has worked to put teams in rotation. They have, you know, Luka has his own natural gravity. Kyrie Irving, who had himself one heck of a first round series against the Clippers. Some of the shooting percentage numbers won't show it, but his impact was just evident throughout this series. Those two draw extra bodies in and of itself. With those post-ups with Luka, how does OKC want to handle it? Do they want to double? And if Dallas counters with, we'll just keep Kyrie one pass away. How does OKC plan to deal with that consistently? Because that feels like a very important battleground. Like the pick and roll stuff, I think is going to be, they'll just mix up looks. We will see drop with Chet Holmgren. We might see some switches. We might see some switching doubles, depending on who Luka's calling up for the screener. The inside the arc stuff with Luka is going to be interesting, which kind of brings like the health into play. How's the knee feeling? How deep is he driving? Because one of the things that popped for me as the series went on, and I think I noted to you during one of our watch parties, I think for game 5 or game 6, I said the Clippers should be a little bit worried that Luka is starting to drive deeper on these. He's starting to get deeper into the paint now. I feel like the comfort is getting there, or he's starting to feel good. I'm just really curious to see how OKC deals with that portion of it.
I think it's fair. I think it's very fair to start there. And I'll make sure I address the Luka point, because there's an element to the playoffs where a team may showcase something that another team could take advantage of. I think it's pretty clear for if you're OKC, we need to make it tough on Luka. We need to make it tough on Kyrie. They got to make us pay. But at the same time, OKC showcasing that first round series, if you don't necessarily have the best answer for Shai Gilgeous-Alexander and Jalen Williams, we know what we can get to outside of just our pure system of driving, kick, cutting, clearing space, opening things up. So when it comes to Luka, I'm just intrigued to see which way OKC goes on defense. Mm-hmm. Do they go with activity? You've mentioned the double teams. You've talked about it all year. Do they want to start that way? I think if Luka's in a post-up against Lu Dort, OKC will stay at home. If Luka's able to start to get some of these switches and these matchups and he has it going, they may see the doubles. We get right back into Dallas. Can you make the defense pay for what they're doing? I think the one that makes me think is Kyrie. One, because of how well he's played. two, not just because of, you know, the shot making, that doesn't really matter what your scheme is doing. It's the drives. So if you're going to be in a drop and Kyrie's going to take those pull-ups and then Kyrie starts splitting and now Kyrie drives. And the thing about OKC, when you talk about their activity, it's not just purely double teams. On drives, they're going to come help. What does that open up? So now if Kyrie's able to hit you with multiple ways to get help and Luka is going to put pressure on you in that way, is that going to be enough to sustain Dallas? And how does OKC adjust from there? Because if drop becomes something that's just not an option, and now they're able to dink switches or two on the ball, you can open some things up for Dallas. On the flip side, you know, actually, I won't go to the flip side. What was your next point? I'm sorry.
Oh, no, you're fine. I was just going to very quickly supplement the Kyrie thing. I just wanted to pull it up very quickly during the regular season matchup per Second Spectrum. 28 drives for Kyrie against OKC. Roughly 1.26 points per possession on those trips. He made them pay, both with his own finishes and just the attention that he was able to attract and some of those driving kicks from there. So I just wanted to sprinkle that in, as you mentioned, the Kyrie point.
Yeah, and it's going to be a little bit of a different series. We're talking just about Dallas's offense. Are there going to be help points for OKC? Absolutely. But they New Orleans showed that you can defend OKC in the playoffs. Did they have enough defense? Not particularly. And did they have enough offense when they got stops? Not particularly. It's a little different with Dallas, to where if Dallas is able to get some of these stops, they're able to run, get easy ones, you find yourself not in a 7-6 battle. You might be down 12-4. And how does that impact your team? So I'm intrigued by that part.
I got you. And that kind of brings me to the other battleground with Dallas, especially in light of Maxi Kleber. He's probably done for the postseason, if I had to guess. No reporting on that front, but shoulder injury seems pretty serious. He's at least in serious question for this round. Are the Dallas bigs ready to switch? And I am more so curious on the Daniel Gafford front than I am with the Derek Lively front. But I think it's important to ask if both of those guys are ready for that challenge, particularly when Shea or Jalen Williams calls them into action. I think Daniel Gafford slides pretty well in space. And like we've had the conversation when he was in Washington, like I feel like switching is probably his best coverage. He doesn't have to worry about the drop depth and things like that. Like I think he's a pretty good athlete. You can simplify things for him in that matter. It's a different challenge against those two. With Derek Lively, I think he's already one of the best switch bigs in basketball. But it's a little bit different when you're dealing with Shea and dealing with Jalen Williams. And again, with Kleber being out, if one of those guys gets in foul trouble, you're going to have to do some serious downsizing. Now, Dallas has counters for that. If we do get the Lively foul trouble game and or the Gafford foul trouble game, like they can go to PJ Washington at the five. But OKC kind of wants you to down. Like, this is what OKC does. Like, they feel comfortable playing small and fast because they are generally small and fast. Now, they're long, so that kind of compensates for some of the pure height stuff. But, like, OKC is comfortable going, like, 6'5", 6'6", across the board. Does Dallas want to play into those hands? So this is going to be a really big Gafford/Lively series. They're going to have to hold up.
Now, here's the thing. It's interesting you mentioned are Dallas's bigs ready to switch? I thought you were going to go right into the matchup stuff. This is your bag.
Oh, I have one. I just don't want to talk for like 10 minutes straight.
No, you're good. But I think it's more, can Dallas make the shift defensively? And is OKC going to be ready for when Dallas is able to switch? Because in theory, this is a different series for Dallas. You know, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander is a different challenge. Jalen Williams is a different challenge because of the element of the drive, the ability to get to their own spot. Overall, as a team, OKC and their flow and their drive and kick and their spacing and their flat screens and their guard screens, they're going to keep pressure on you some type of way. You know, Chet Holmgren has the element of popping and driving. So, you know, as a team, are you going to be ready for that shift coming off a series against the Clippers, who found movement in game 4 and then lost movement in game 5 and 6? So you kind of have to shift there. When it comes to the matchups, in my head, this is the way I'm going, right? I'm thinking we see Luka on Dort. I'm thinking we see Kyrie on Jalen Williams. I think Gafford gets the Giddy matchup. I would assume just you put PJ on Chet, you put Derrick Jones Jr. on Shea. And in theory, what that does is OKC likely either uses Giddy as a hub or as a screener. You can either keep those pick and rolls on the side or you can just turn that drop into a late switch. Not easy because, again, Shea's going to get to his spot regardless, but you have a comfort level there. You could switch the Chet Holmgren pick and rolls. And then when you do that switch, let's say Luka's involved, you don't want to have Luka in the switch. You can just have the big take Chet then on the roll, and now Luka flows back out. So I just think there's a lot of different things that Dallas can kind of mess around with. Is OKC ready for those moments when Dallas is able to switch and flow and keep the ball in front and make sure that things are a little bit slower tempo-wise for the Thunder, that things aren't as easy for the Thunder to get to that driving kick, that there's a wall in front of them. Just the help and recover aspect is going to be fun to force OKC to execute in the half court.
Yeah, like that's going to be an important background, like as you flow to the matchups. I remember going back through the matchups both last night and a little bit this morning, like thinking that February 10th matchup when, again, Dallas just blew OKC out the water. And that felt like the loudest, holy crap, the Mavericks, you might want to keep an eye on them type statement game. I think it was Josh Green getting Shea and Derrick Jones Jr. was on Chet in that game. So they could just turn those into switches and kind of flatten OKC out in that way. This, I guess I'll go ahead and spoil my X Factor. Like, this is going to be a big series for Josh Giddey. Because, like, one of the quieter storylines, you know, post All-Star break was Giddey knocking down shots from the perimeter. And not just knocking down shots from the perimeter, like just taking shots in rhythm. There wasn't really any hesitation there when he was spaced. If he is able to be used as a hub, if he's able to be used as a screener, and ultimately, if he knocks down enough shots while being spaced, I don't know what the threshold is for him offensively to where Dallas feels like they need to switch the matchups and kind of go away from like Gafford or insert center here on Giddey. But like he has at least shown over an extended sample at this point, I will make enough to where we can just win this game because I made enough in addition to these stars doing the thing. Like he had, what, a 23-point game against New Orleans in the first round series. And so like I am really intrigued to see just what that's going to look like offensively for him. Like first possession of the game might just be Giddey initiates, they get into their stagger stuff with Shea. And Jalen and Chet and Shea loops around, comes back up. They have all the fun from there. So we'll see. Dallas is switching on ball. Obviously going to play a big part in this one. They're switching off the ball is going to have to be on point. Because more than the Clippers, like, these guys will cut. They will slip. Mm-hmm. The Clippers, you switch, you bog them down. That's just kind of it. And then they can still win because of the shot-making talent. But OKC will just get out of there. And like something that we've talked about all year long, the different angles that OKC will set their screens with. I've been talking all year about they will just literally use anyone as a screener. So that part's going to be fun. Like, I can't wait till we get some of the hybrid second units. You have Isaiah Joe set an off-ball screen for Shea and seeing how Dallas plays with that way. Like there are a lot of things for Dallas to have to sort through here. So that defensive communication is going to have to be clean.
Off-ball screen or, you know, stack pick and roll where Isaiah Joe, oh, now you see me, now you don't.
Here I'm I on go. That wing now.
I'll quickly spoil. I had a couple more questions. I'll quickly spoil my X factor for the Thunder. Cason Wallace.
I like this one. Do tell.
I've been thinking about they're going to need him in this series on both ends of the floor. At some point, OKC is going to have to find a lineup to where there's limited help points, or we feel more comfortable with the help points, or we feel we can make you pay. And I think Cason Wallace, this might be his type of series. Just because Lu Dort's going to play. Like, him and Luka, he's going to be right there fighting Luka. It's one of my favorite matchups to watch just because of the activity versus Luka just casually stepping back and making shots. That's always fun. But I think they're going to need Cason Wallace to balance things out for them. Knock down some shots, drive some closeouts, and his ability to, you know, he's taking the Luka matchup. He can go defend Kyrie. That can help OKC on that end of the floor. So I think this is a Cason Wallace series. I think at some point he's going to shine for them.
Okay. While we're on the bench, can I hit you with like two free throw adjacent questions?
Yeah.
Who do you trust more to have a positive impact in the series, Isaiah Joe or Tim Hardaway Jr.?
That's interesting. That's interesting framing on that one. I would probably say Tim Hardaway Jr. has the higher ceiling and may become more important considering they lost Maxi Kleber. I'm gonna go Joe because the 3-point shooting is there. And OKC can generate shots for him.
Okay.
But and then similarly, I do think Tim Hardaway Jr. is gonna have an impact on this series.
Okay. And then similarly, who do you trust to have a positive impact in the series more? Gordon Hayward or Dante Exum?
Oh man, it's Dante Exum for me.
Okay,
I think Gordon Hayward took a shot in the last playoff series, a singular one. So it's drive and it's not even drive. What's the enhanced version of drive and kick? I just shorten it.
Drive and kick push, but no, the Hayward's acquisition has not hit the way that I thought it would. Not that he still can't have an impact in this series. Like, he still has the skill set to puncture Dallas's defense and just to be able to capitalize on some of the opportunities created for him. Would like for him to be a little bit more aggressive. So I just wanted to toss those at you.
No, I see what you did. Well done. Salute to you. Good job. A receipt will be coming your way. No worries. I just think this is the other flip side of Hayward joining the Thunder midseason, to where you saw what the ceiling could be, but part of it was the bonus was they didn't need him. So as he's working to fit in and work into what the Thunder do, a specific style of play, we want you to help us. We think you could help us, but if it's not working, we have other options. So, you know, that's kind of the give and take.
Okay. I have another question for you, which kind of bleeds into my X Factor thing, but I'll toss it at you either way. We talked about OKC's rebounding earlier in the year. We talked about the rebounding last year as well, but we talked about OKC's rebounder earlier in the year. We ended up getting a mailbag question post All-Star break because OKC had quietly drastically improved their defensive rebounding in particular. How do you feel about their ability to end possessions heading into the series with Dallas?
I feel fine.
You feel fine?
Yeah, they've done a really good job of rebounding as a team. Well, what say you, sir?
This feels like one of the bigger swing factors of the series, honestly. Because while OKC has improved, like, this is probably where Daniel Gafford has loomed the largest, or it looms the largest in terms of just the impact he can have on this one. Because more than we put him on Josh Giddey, he can roam around the rim, block some shots. Obviously important. His ability to just play volleyball after missed shots, like, that's something that really popped in that February matchup. To where OKC just did not have an answer for him. And I want to say the March matchup without Luka as well. They were just very Kyrie heavy. But I want to say in both of those, a lot of offensive rebounds for Dallas. And I do wonder, like, how many games that can swing. Either Daniel Gafford just has like 17 and 12 with 5 offensive rebounds and Dallas wins, or OKC does such a good job of getting rebounding that we don't have one of those games from Daniel Gafford. And now this series is more lopsided in favor of OKC than even Thunder enthusiasts anticipated, because Dallas can't win the possession battle. So, like, I feel okay about it. I would have my brow raised if I'm a Thunder fan, a Thunder enjoyer, because Gafford can just do that. And if you're getting more Derek Lively, he's also someone that is, yeah, not the biggest body, but he is tall. He has the length, and he is certainly a gold pogo stick for the 2K watchers in here. Like, this could be where, if the jumper doesn't come back for Luka, which sounds funny considering how many shots he's made, but like, if Luka doesn't have the efficient 3-point shooting series, or if Kyrie doesn't have the true breakout from three, there is still a pathway for Dallas to score efficiently and to score a bunch if they're just able to get a bunch of extra opportunities. So that feels like a very, let's see what game one looks like. Let's see who's really up for that particular challenge, which I guess from there flows into Daniel Gafford being my biggest Dallas X factor. Like, I was between him. I initially had PJ Washington down because I think he's going to see Chet. He's going to see Shea, either as far as either him getting the matchup outright or because he's going to be switching on to Shea. That's going to be important for PJ. But man, Gafford, the lob threat that he is, the offensive rebounder threat that he is, the weak side rim protector that he can be, he can just affect so many things at the rim. And as we've talked a lot about OKC, the drives, the screens, even the way that they fly around defensively, so much of that is built around we want to win the paint. With our drives, we want to win the paint. With these doubles on these post-ups, we want to make sure you're not getting into the paint or getting to the free throw line. We are scrambling to prevent you from winning this area. Daniel Gafford could absolutely win that area for Dallas. But if this ends up being the foul trouble series for him, or he's just not holding up in space whenever he's asked to switch, that's a lot of pressure to put on Derek Lively to hold down the fort. Or if they further downsize and go to PJ at the five, that's a lot of strain on those two guys if Gafford can't hold up his deal to the bargain. He doesn't have to be 36 minutes a game, 18 and 12 or anything like that. If this turns into Daniel Gafford's averaging 16 minutes a game in the series, I feel like that spells some trouble for Dallas. So he's probably my biggest X factor for Dallas. And for OKC, we already talked about him, but Josh Giddey. I don't want to rehash what I literally said like 8 minutes ago, but shooting, playmaking, the screening, he's going to have to hold up defensively as well.
So, did you say you didn't want to rehash it while serving us rehash browns?
Rehash browns is good. I'll give you the hat tip there. That's good stuff.
Thank you. Derek Jones Jr. is going to be my X factor for Dallas.
Okay.
We saw the impact that his defense on Paul George had last series. I assume he'll get a nice amount of battles against Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. They need him defensively. But also, when he's able to make threes, and he shot 56.3% against the Thunder in the regular season from three, when he's able to drive closeouts, that just adds an element. And so if they have him going, finding the gaps, if they have PJ Washington going, finding the gaps, especially with no Maxi Kleber, they need those two guys to step up. And I think if Derrick Jones Jr. plays at a high enough level, that Dallas team feels a little bit different on both ends of the floor.
Okay, that's good stuff. That is good stuff. And I would just say, very quickly, I think we've talked about all the major players in this one. We can go deeper, but we have other things to talk about.
I have a question. Yeah. We're going to see if you hit it.
Okay. I just want to say very quickly on the Chet front. Averaged 12 and 10 during the regular season series. Shot 40% from three. 2.5 attempts per game. Like, some of that is the switching. Some of that, especially earlier on in the series, was some of the question that we had about Chet. We know he can shoot. Is he willing to take 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 of these as he's open? Or are we going to get some of the hesitations? Like, heading into this series, I think it's going to be more of a switch deal. But I do wonder how comfortable he's going to be pulling over smaller defenders. Like, okay, you're not just going to have the wide open above the break three on a pop. This is going to be a switch. If insert guard here, or if, you know, if Luka's now switching out to you, are you willing to just take the shot over him because you're bigger than him and he's not going to affect your shot like that? Or is this just going to turn into, I need to hand it off elsewhere in space? 2.5 3-point attempts, I don't think is going to cut it for Chet.
I was going to ask, what's your concern level with Chet in this
one? Okay, there we go. Concern is probably too strong of a word. Like, I'd probably say intrigue would be a more accurate descriptor, because I do think, like, I think the defense can be important for him. I think the shooting can hit, the drives can hit. I do anticipate him seeing a lot of switching. So I just want to see how aggressive he's going to be, depending on who the matchup is going to be. Like, I think that's where, kind of zooming back to not just the regular season matchups, but just his regular season in general. Like, watching the progression of, oh, my, he's driving a bunch. Wait, they're starting to bother the handle. Hey, he's being super aggressive seeking out contact. Hey, here are some of these, like, turnaround jumpers that he's starting to sprinkle in. Like, he's adding more to, like, the scoring package inside the arc. Even if it doesn't go down, it's a good thing that he feels comfortable going to some of these counters when he does see switches. So, like, I feel like this is a series to where he may have to have all that on display. Because, like, I just don't think, unless Gafford takes that matchup to start, which I don't anticipate, but not out of the question considering they're both the starting fives. But unless we get that, like, I don't think we're going to see the pure pop opportunities like we saw in the New Orleans series where he's just open and can make a decision from there. So he's going to have to be decisive in this one. I'm intrigued. I'm not super worried about him yet. I will say, like, similar to Gafford, they can't afford foul trouble from him because of how important he is and because they don't have Kleber throwing for more switching. We cannot, if you're OKC, you cannot have the Chet Holmgren foul trouble game. They have other options, but the level of attention I think Dallas would show to a Jalen Williams or a Kenrich Williams if they want to downsize is just a lot different than Chet in the impact he can have. So that's where I'm at with Chet heading into the series, at least. Who do you have in this one?
Fun. The fans win. Learn my lesson. That's a joke. I think there's paths for both teams just going into it preview-wise. Luka, Kyrie, they have it going. You get some added offense. Defensively, you're able to get some stops. You feel comfortable with Luka occasionally guarding Jalen Williams, Kyrie guarding Jalen Williams. You make his baskets tough. You take Chet off the table with switching. There's a pathway for Dallas to get there. Now for OKC, we make it tough on Kyrie or Luka. We funnel shots to the places we want to. We keep our flow offensively. We drive, drive, drive. We keep the pressure on, get guys in foul trouble. We use all our stops to push and run in transition and score. I think that Dallas has a legit shot in the series. I think they're going to hit the Thunder at some point. I do trust the Thunder and who they are as a team, their identity, and their ability to adjust and work through it. The Pelican series was not the prettiest series, but they kept working to find and get back to what they do so well. And they're going to be challenged, but I'm going to go OKC in seven. I think if Maxi Kleber was healthy, you probably catch me with Dallas in six. That's a lot of bodies and lineup versatility, and you need a lot of guys to hit if you're Dallas on both ends of the floor. Not that it can't be done, but I'm gonna go with the Thunder figuring it out down the stretch.
Okay, I got you. I'm gonna be honest, like without the Luka knee thing, and to a lesser degree, Maxi Kleber, because I do think, again, his switchability and just the random game or two that he will hit threes can be impactful here. Without the Luka thing in particular, like, I think I would just pick Dallas in this one. Because I feel like OKC kind of has more things to solve than Dallas does in this matchup. And I kind of lean back to some of the similar arguments I had with Dallas and LA. Like, there is just a collective size that Dallas has that they can shrink the floor. I already touched on some of the rebounding stuff with Daniel Gafford in particular. But like, I don't know how right Luka is going to be as the series goes on, because I don't think this is going to be a short series at all. Like, I think it's six or seven. And I think in light of that, and in light of just the general trust in OKC being able to drive the basketball, like, I think they'll be able to find cracks. It'll probably be a little bit harder than anticipated, just because, again, Dallas's defense has been very good post All-Star break. I'm probably with you with Thunder in seven.
Oh, let me make everyone mad then. Dallas in six.
Oh, that's that's fine. Now, so yeah, I could just, like, as you bullied me into Magic in seven, I could tell you to stand on Thunder and set, but no, like, I think this is going to be a long series, and I would not be surprised at all if Dallas wins this one. But we will leave it there. Let's get to this game one between the Minnesota Timberwolves and the Denver Nuggets. The Wolves with a 106-99 victory. They have a 1-0 series lead. Big win on the road. Starts with Anthony Edwards, 43 points, 7 rebounds, 3 assists, but only 1 turnover, a steal, and 2 blocks. Anthony Edwards joins 2001 Kobe Bryant as the only player to have back-to-back 40-point games at the age of 22 or younger. Now, we got 14 and 10 from Mike Conley. We got 20 points for Karl-Anthony Towns, 6 points, 13 rebounds, 3 blocks, and a steal for Rudy Gobert, 16 off the bench for Naz Reid, and boy, did that man have a second-half flurry. It starts with Ant with me, man. Like, that is just the story of the game. And it felt like an extension of a lot of what we talked about and applauded Ant for in the Phoenix series. Just mature basketball being played. This is what you're showing me. This is what I'm going to take. If we're in a half-court situation and the defense is set and you're trying to show a body at the nail, I can either just get off of it and let my teammates play out of this. Or if one of my teammates cuts through, I can now take a couple dribbles, operate in the mid-range area. I can rise up, use my shoulder to create a little bit of extra space, and I can just rise up, sprinkle in these jumpers. And again, like, I don't think the three assists really highlight how good of a passing game or playmaking game that he had. Like, I think he nailed like 95% of the reads that he was supposed to make. But it's just pure drive and kick and pick and roll coming off of handoffs, early transition attacks. He found a gap. And then based on what the defense did from Denver, I'm attacking or I'm passing over here. And just him being able to maintain that on the road against the defending champs is super impressive. And that's before getting into like some of the legitimate highlights that the man had. Like, one, I should actually rewind. He set the tone on defense in this one. First possession of the game, let me just hound Jamal Murray over pick and roll. They reset after a Jokic post up. Murray tries to go again. Ant fights over. And then it's just 4 to 5 seconds of really strong isolation defense. Jamal Murray didn't have anything for him. And then Jokic gets called for, I think, the offensive three in the key from there. And I was like, oh. I think I noted on Twitter and during the watch party. Oh, I thought we were just going to see Jaden McDaniels on Jamal Murray like we always do. And we eventually got there. But it was cool as a basketball fan to see Ant saying, nah, let me show you I'm here real quick. This may not be the primary matchup, but I'm going to let you know I will get in your jersey too. You can get some too. And between the defense, there was the, I wish I could remember which quarter it was in off the top of my head, but ends up being off-ball action. He switches onto Jokic. They dump it into Jokic. There's a cut from there, and then he gets a block with his offhand. And I'm just like, this man is incredible when he's locked in defensively. When he can give you that on-ball, when he can make those kind of off-ball plays, and then offensively, he can get into the teeth of your defense. He can sprinkle in mid-range jumpers. Late game, we can just clear aside and let him sprinkle in post-fadeaway after post-fadeaway. If you're in a drop, he can still pull up from three. He showcased everything. And so my story starts with Anthony Edwards. Like, I have Denver, I have Minnesota defense thoughts too, but I just want to give Ant his flowers first. That was just an incredible basketball game on both ends of the floor.
I agree. It was. He's had a great playoff run. We've talked about it a bunch. Well, I'm only saying because when if you're watching this or listening to this, it's going to be Tuesday. Game two has already happened, right? And so in my mind, I'm thinking about some of the things that could happen. So what else did you want to hit, Nikias?
I think just on the Minnesota front, one, their defense was incredible. They went with Cat on Jokic. They had Rudy Gobert roaming around. I think that largely went well. Though, as I'll leave it for you to get into the specifics, but when Jokic did get the Gobert switch or the Gobert matchup, like, that looked a little bit different than some of the other possessions. And I'll leave that for you to opine on, because I know you have thoughts there. Had fun watching JD navigate screens, Nikhil Alexander Walker navigating screens. I will say, in terms of looking at potential game two adjustments, I do wonder how often Denver looks to poke at Mike Conley, not because he's a bad defender, but because Mike Conley showed, it was a lot of show and recover from Mike Conley. And so I wonder how often Denver tries to poke at that as as a way to get Minnesota in rotation. Again, not Conley's bad, go at him and get him in foul trouble, anything like that. It just felt like, I think it was only 5 reps of screener as Conley as the screener defender in game one. And that just felt low, considering what some of the other offensive possessions for Denver looked like. So I do wonder if that's going to be an adjustment to where they can try to get Jamal Murray either going downhill if he gets the switch, or if it is going to be a show and recover, all right, let's let Jokic play out of this and let's see if we can open up. So like that's on my mind as well. Again, not Conley slander. Want to be very clear on that front. Just more of a scheme / coverage deal. And if Denver can poke at that.
Well, I think the biggest thing is Minnesota put a lot on the table in that game one win that Denver now has to work to take off the table in game two. So I'm very intrigued to see what they hit and how they hit it. The impact of what Mike Conley, Karl-Anthony Towns, and Naz Reid did in the second half was huge for Minnesota. And Coach Michael Malone highlighted it post-game, and I'm interested to see how they work to take them off the table. And I'm interested to see if Denver feels a better comfort on both ends of the floor, because it's very clear this Minnesota team that's not going away. They're looking to come in and take this series, and Denver's going to have to respond. I think Karl Anthony Towns being able to hold up on both ends is something that Denver has to poke at. If he's able to drive against Aaron Gordon, that's one thing. You know, I think if he can get to his spots in that matchup, that's huge, especially considering some of the second unit battle where Aaron Gordon's at the five and the Wolves have Kat and Naz Reid in there. That becomes key. Denver's okay with still switching KCP or Jamal Murray on the Kat. If Kat can once again be decisive, catch the ball in space, get right to his drive and finish, that's something that makes it hard for Denver to sustain defense throughout the entire game. And I think overall, I'm interested to see what the adjustment is for Denver as far as being able to contain the drive a little bit better and understanding this isn't purely just a pick and roll or set series. You're going to have to defend and build your help points out in a different way. You know, it's pick and roll. They have to have their rotations locked in. Are they going to go two on the ball? Are they going to go drop? Are they going to be able to recover and contain the ball? If they do defend well, can they contain the next drive? If Minnesota could just live and drive and kick with what Ant's doing, with what Cat's doing, it makes it really tough. So I want to see how they're able to handle that. Mm-hmm. You mentioned, and actually, you know what? Because if it's going to be that playmaking blend with all these things on the table, Minnesota has a really good chance to take this. You mentioned Minnesota's defense and the brilliance of Rudy Gobert as far as the timing on when to roam and when to help. And I think for Denver offensively, again, it's about poking at what Minnesota did because Minnesota defended with conviction. You know, Rudy Gobert, it wasn't just, you know, I'm defending Aaron Gordon at the dunker spot. I'm going to roam and help and stunt and recover and take the lob away. He was there on post-ups. He was there just causing havoc no matter where they put Aaron Gordon. So now it's on Denver to flip that against Minnesota. One of the biggest keys to that working was the screen navigation from Minnesota's guards and wings. If we get into a scenario where Denver sets higher screens and they get a clean hit, Jamal Murray had a lot of space to operate with. Mm-hmm. And if Jamal Murray is going to have that space and be able to take and make those shots, are you as comfortable with it? Because there were possessions where Karl Anthony Towns was literally just like, actually, not my job. I'm going to get back to Jokic on this short roll, which sounds great until you realize the possessions where Jamal Murray just turned the corner and finished. Of course, Rudy's lurking, but there's an element of Denver's offense where they don't have to go to where that help is. And that's where I'm interested to see in how does Denver explore that space? You know, can we get Jokic clear a wing, get him just on the short roll? Can Jamal Murray take and make those shots? Can you just poke at Kat? Do you go with the inverted pick and roll to make Rudy switch on to Jokic and Jokic goes to work, or you at least have gotten away from that alignment? That's where I think Denver's most important battles lie to flip some of what Minnesota did back onto them. Mm-hmm. But I think offensively is the big key.
Okay. I'm glad you brought up like the Cat portion of things, because that was one thing I wanted to ask you about, actually, just how you felt about that gambit, because it felt like there was a real emphasis from Cat in particular. We are not opening up some of these pocket passes to Jokic and letting him get in rhythm and getting right into the float and things like that. I'm going to trust Jaden or whoever's guarding Jamal Murray to navigate. I'm taking this. And in the event that Jamal Murray is able to get all the way downhill, my guy gets clipped. Now it's Rudy on Aaron Gordon, so Rudy can step up and kind of take these things away. And so I found it interesting, but it does feel like, to your point, like there is a lot of early space, because it didn't feel like, at least on first watch, it didn't feel like a lot of like heavy nail help is in early. We're going to make sure that Jamal Murray sees hands on the first level of defense, and then he's got to meet Rudy at the rim on top of that. Like, to your point, it did feel like a lot of space for Jamal. And so I do wonder how much of this flips, more than any schematic tweak for Denver, how much of a flip is if Jamal Murray just hits pull-up jumpers inside the arc now? Like, one of the first misses of the game for Jamal Murray was like a floater against Rudy and drop. And it's just like, well, that's kind of the point with Rudy and a drop. Like, you don't want to give up shots at the rim and get free throws and things like that. You don't want to give up threes. You can live within this 7 to 20 foot range. Do what you want to do. But those are still comfortable looks for Jamal Murray. And so if Jamal Murray is able to make them in game two or moving forward, do we see higher help from Minnesota? Do we just see more attention being shown inside the arc outside of Rudy's at the rim because Aaron Gordon's in the dunker spot? And what does that mean for Denver's offense? Because, like, one of the funnier things, like, we've talked about, and I know I brought up Denver shot profile during the regular season. Not a team that takes a lot of threes. They've hit them at a solid clip, but they're not an elite three-point shooting team. Denver made over 40% of their threes, and they took more threes than Minnesota did in that game. And so it was kind of weird for Denver to have that kind of game, but because they weren't able to nail enough of the mid-range jumpers or do enough in the paint in particular, one of the things I noted was because of how Jokic was being defended and because of some of the shots that Jokic took in that game one, only three offensive rebounds for Denver. And I remember bringing up on the preview ahead of time, like, I made sure to note, like, Rudy, Nas, and Kat missed one of the games. There was also another game that Kat missed. But Denver rebounded over 30% of their own misses during the regular season series. And I wondered how much of that is going to be real with this team being healthy. It was not real at all in the game one. And so if Murray gets going, does that open up more of those short roll opportunities for Jokic? Does they get more rotation? Do you get Jokic closer to the rim on some of these shot attempts? And so one, he just has easier scoring opportunities, but you also maybe get the secondary benefit of it's a jump hook instead of a floater. If he misses, he gets his own rebound, and Jokic is one of the best players in the league at getting that initial offensive rebound, just putting it right back in. So just winning on the margins in that way is something I'm going to be looking at in game two and moving forward.
It's fair. It's fair. Totally understand. And I'm glad you're new to seeing things, Nikias. I think the biggest thing is just Denver has to work to get through their options. Drive and kick. You don't have to always drive right at Rudy Gobert if he's helping deep in the paint. And then you have to make Minnesota not defend with as much conviction as they did in game one. Mm-hmm. If you can poke at Kat and drop. If you can have Jokic score against Rudy in the post. If you can get Jamal Murray going. What's the adjustment? If Rudy Gobert gets in foul trouble, what's the adjustment? Can you make Minnesota blink? And then I do feel like Denver may be caught between coverages as far as what they want to do. And they've got to clean up the help. They've got to clean up the rotations. They've got to keep the ball in front. So those are things, hopefully, that we will have seen in this game, too, that we have not seen quite yet because it hasn't happened yet. But if Minnesota is going to be able to defend like that and get multiple contributions from everyone, I mean, heck, this is a question I've asked on this podcast. Hey, who does Minnesota close with? I literally thought in a positive direction between Kat, Nas, and Rudy, who do you close with? That's growth. Team's got an identity.
It's good stuff. Like, I was surprised because Nas was just cooking that second half. And we got to the 3-minute mark and Kat subbed back in. And it was a genuine, wow, I can't believe they brought Kat back in. Not because Kat was having a bad game. Now, Kat did have the 5 fouls. So that portion was obviously negative. But like Kat had drives going, he knocked down some threes. Like he's generally performing well. But it felt like a surprise that he came back in because of how well Nas performing. And like circling back to, you know, year one of this team with all three of those bigs. One of the questions we both had was, what exactly do you do with all three of these guys? Can you play all three of them? Can you find coverages for everyone? What does the offense look like? The fact that you had a game where you saw the Rudy defensive impact, the Kat offensive impact inside and outside the arc, and the Nas Reed impact, both as a shooter and as a driver. That's literally the vision of what Minnesota wanted to build. We want to say complimentary, I don't know how I want to close with these three, because all three of them bring something that will help us win. And so it was really cool to see that play out.
Can I raise my hand real quick?
Sure.
An added layer. First, congratulations to Rudy Gobert for becoming a father for the first time. He is questionable for game two due to the birth of the child this morning. So wanted to add that layer in there.
Okay. Well, depending on if he plays or not, I guess we'll get an answer to what's the counter way quicker than we anticipated. My goodness. Any other player shout outs or questions or scheme things?
Nah, I think we had some fun.
I'll just say very quickly, circling back to Ant. I didn't expect him to move Kentavious Caldwell-Pope the way that he did, or explode past Kentavious Caldwell-Pope the way that he did. And I do wonder, because I think KCP picked up like the ankle thing later in the Lakers series. Like, I wonder how much that is affecting him, if at all. Because like Ant is just generally more explosive than him, so it could just be that. But I do wonder like how KCP is feeling in terms of the ankle and if that's any kind of hindrance. And one of the things I asked you heading into the series was, who gets Ant? Like, do we see Aaron Gordon on Ant at any point in time? You saw it late in the fourth quarter and was able to draw a shooting foul going to his right. But I do wonder, like, again, this is probably more of a game three or game four question. But does Denver do anything differently in terms of the matchup against Ant beyond what coverage they may throw at him? So that's the only other thing I had there. We'll also note on the Nas refront, 16 points off the bench for Nas. Denver's bench had 15 points. So you might want a little bit more bench production if you are the Denver Nuggets. But we will leave it there. Get into some closing thoughts with some of these series. Again, the Cleveland Cavaliers able to knock off the Orlando Magic 106-94. On Sunday, Orlando can create up to $58 million in cap space if they renounce cap holes and decline team options. I think Jonathan Isaac has a non-guaranteed deal worth a little over $17 million. If they want to just flat out waive him, they can. I don't know if they do because of how important he was to their defense, but that option does exist. Per Shams Charania of The Athletic, I think he said so on FanDuel TV at this point, the Magic and Klay Thompson have mutual interests. So I'll ask you, I guess a two-parter. One, how much do you think that is real versus Klay saying, they got money and I fit here. Hey, Golden State, I want my money. And two, how would you feel about the Klay and Orlando fit?
I feel fine with it. Klay can shoot. Klay won't have to bear all the defense weight. They got playmakers around them. I wouldn't mind that fit at all. I think for Orlando, it's a very positive direction. Unfortunately, you came up short in the playoffs, but you have Paolo, who has shown that he can play at a very high level and should only get better. You have Franz, who season didn't end the way he wanted to, but he's continuing to improve. You've got Jalen Suggs legitimately contributing on both ends of the floor, which is big. Your bench has been very good. And I think it gets interesting because of the way it's built with Paolo and Franz and their ability to make plays and have the ball in their hands and the different ways you can use them. It does open up for a little bit of a different roster construction to a degree to where, hey, maybe it's just a shooter. I think they do need to add shooting. That would definitely help them, especially add movement to their sets. But also, you know, we may need a quote unquote creating guard, but they don't have to be a pure creating guard, if that makes sense. I've seen 98 people say Anthony Simons' name, but a guard like that makes sense. You know what I mean? Or even if like, would that make sense to be like a Malik Monk destination or a Buddy Hield destination? Now the balance is Orlando has built this. So how do they balance kind of keeping their own with adding to what they've built?
Yeah.
And so is it as simple as, do we upgrade and try and get a better big? Do we try and get a big that's a little bit more flexible for us? How much of a facilitator do we need? How many shooters do we need? And can they do what we need defensively?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, dude, you still have a bunch of guards there. So it's interesting to see how they attack that.
It's going to be interesting. I'm glad you brought up like Anthony Simons and stuff. Cause like one of the questions I was going to ask you is like archetype wise, would you prefer to see them go after like pull up guard or wing, you know, movement shooter? I think the, you know, theoretically, like you're just trying to upgrade the Gary Harris spot. It's just, do we want a guard to move Jalen Suggs more to the two, or do you want like a shooter wing type? So Jalen Suggs still kind of like your, I guess your lead guard per se. Obviously, so much of the offense is just being ran through Paolo and Franz. So like they're kind of, they're the offense runners, but you get what I mean.
In that scenario, I would still lean with the shooting wing.
Okay.
But that's so just
that,
me.
That would certainly fit. Yeah, okay. Oh, that would certainly fit the Klay mold. And to a lesser extent, you mentioned Buddy Hield. Like that would also be there. And I would imagine Buddy is going to be the more salary friendly option there if they aren't able to land Klay Thompson. So we'll keep an eye on Orlando's offseason. And with the Dallas Mavericks knocking off the Los Angeles Clippers, obviously their offseason has started. Potential free agents for them: James Harden, Mason Plumlee, Daniel Tice, who we just didn't see Tice in the first round series, which is interesting. And in terms of player options, you got Paul George, PJ Tucker, who I'm just going to take the guess that PJ Tucker is going to accept his player option worth over $11 million. And Russell Westbrook, who has seen criticism to the point where he felt the need to release a statement. So that is interesting to say the least. But with the Paul George thing, because we did get another report from Shams saying that the Clippers obviously want Paul George back, but they've offered nothing but below the max deals to PG, and PG has not accepted any of those. If you are the Clippers, do you eventually get to max money with Paul George? Or do you kind of draw your line in the sand there?
I guess the tough part for the Clippers in theory, right? What's the market for Paul George? And are you going to be priced out by default?
I mean, if Orlando and Philadelphia can get to max slots, that does get funny. At a bare minimum, like, that's legitimate leverage, I would imagine, for Paul George. In addition to, hey, Mr. Ballmer, you know we're moving into this new arena, right? Like, you know you want stars, etc. Do you really want to do this with me when I can go to these playoff teams and, like, be good? Are you sure you want to play this game? So I would bet, like, he at least has leverage. Like, again, I don't know how real his interest would be in either of those spots. Like, I would imagine he has more interest in Philly than Orlando. But I feel like there's room for, like, some real haggling here. Like, I think at bare minimum, like, we probably see Paul George opt out. And maybe we get, like, you know, a few days into the moratorium period. And we see, make him sweat a little bit, and then he's back in L.A. Like, if I had to guess today, like, I think he's just a Clipper next year. But I think this, there's some real smoke to this.
So what's funnier? Paul George, you were a Philadelphia 76er, or James Harden, you were an Orlando Magic?
Oh, boy.
Just wanted that reaction. That's all I wanted. You don't have to answer. It wasn't a serious question.
Yeah, that is. That is something. I was talking about extensions. I guess we are also keeping an eye on Ty Lue. Did not have extension talks throughout the regular season per Shams Charania, but the Clippers want to lock him up. As you've seen various coaching tweets and reports, the Lakers very much are interested in Ty Lue if he shakes free. So we will be keeping an eye on that. We'll see what happens there. Before we close out, we did get W preseason play. Didn't get a lot of W preseason streams for hashtag reasons. That'll be another podcast. Oh, here
you go, man. If you don't stop,
we will.
Don't bring this here, man.
Okay, we're not going to do that. But of the preseason play that you were able to see, any player pop for you? Any scheme thing pop for you? What caught your eye over the weekend?
There's plenty of things that pop for me. What popped for you, big dog?
Well, unroll scroll. We did get the Caitlin Clark debut, which she took all of the threes, which that was fun. But beyond that, like, the level of space that she had to operate with kind of stood out to me, like, in terms of the drives. Dallas immediately saying, Tierra McCowan, we need you at the level of this pick and roll against Caitlin Clark, which I have my own separate thoughts about Big T at the level, but we'll save that for season preview stuff.
Save it for season preview. It's the same thought that you've had with Tierra McCowan for the last 3 years, Nikias. I will not let you get away with this.
I do not feel comfortable with her playing that high up on the floor. Like, I appreciate Dallas experimenting with it, and, like, there is a level of scheme versatility that you need, considering that the Wings are just a playoff team or have been. It just hasn't looked great. You know what I mean? But anyway, Caitlin getting that attention was interesting. And then just zooming out to Indiana as a whole, I am very excited about the things that they could run. Either just new things they can sprinkle in, or just kind of accentuating the things that they already do. Like, one of the clips that I tweeted out as I was threading that game, just as simple as, here's Caitlin Clark setting a cross screen for Nelissa Smith while an Erica Wheeler pick and roll is going on with Aaliyah Boston. And from there, you can just go to Nelissa on the block. You can hit Aaliyah if you want. As Caitlin lifts up after that screen, you can hit Caitlin Clark if you want to. I think on the possession that I clip, Erica Wheeler just says, oh, while y'all doing that, I'm just driving to the basket. And she ended up, I think she missed that layup. But I'm just like, oh, they can just do all of these things. Or they can just empty a side and just have all of the fun. They can run Caitlin off of an exit screen while pick and roll things are happening with Erica Wheeler and Aaliyah Boston. And this is a preseason game in which Kelsey Mitchell didn't play. This is all-star guard Kelsey Mitchell. Like, I'm really excited about what the offense is going to look like. And on the Dallas side, the Arike game winner was super fun. Beyond that, hello, Jaylen Brown, another wing that went to Cal, who's named Jaylen Brown, which is just funny for reasons. But beyond that, she shot the heck out of the ball. Not just threes, getting to some pull-ups as well. And as long as Satu Sabally is out, there's a natural scoring void to be filled there and a shooting void to be filled in general. Because I think perimeter shooting just remains a question for the Dallas Wings heading into the year. I am not expecting Jaylen Brown to be Satu, because of course not. That's an all-W player. But if she does add, if she adds an element of volume three-point shooting, I do wonder how much that helps Dallas's offense. So I'm curious on that front.
To the Wings, that was their, I believe, sole preseason game. It's going to be very interesting to see how they navigate things offensively without Satu. It was very quick to realize how important she was to that offense. I was impressed by the play of J.C. Sheldon. I'm very intrigued by how that usage goes. To the Fever, I think you nailed the flow portion. Hopefully the tempo stays up. But there is certainly an aspect with Caitlin Clark where, oh, she's just going to shoot that. And then she just kept doing that. And so as as Indiana flows and they go side to side and they run different actions, there's a lot of potential for them to kind of open things up and play. But I do think it's interesting to watch as she's able to balance doing some of the quote unquote Caitlin Clark things while also, oh yeah, if I drive this help, I can just kick it. And now we just keep playing off that advantage. So how that grows is going to be interesting. The Minnesota Lynx and the Washington Mystics, get your tickets now, bud. Get your tickets now, buddy. I am all in on the Lynx and all the movement they have, the screening actions. I think they're going to be very annoying to play against. Also for the Mystics, I think that the Sparks intrigue me.
Do they?
A little bit, I think.
Okay. You sound very sure about this.
Maybe. I was more surprised by how intrigued I was. Like there was just a oh yeah, De'Arica Hamby, huh?
Yeah, she was good.
There's a lot here. You know what I mean? As far as just players who know how they play, I don't know how it will shake out win wise, but it's like, yeah, they're gonna be smart and they're gonna play hard. Like it's gonna be a very competitive league. I thought it was nice to see some of the potential of the Storm and the Big Three as far as just actions, where it's like, oh yeah, dribble handoff, empty side. This is not fun. I now have to help as Jewel Lloyd comes off a handoff from NECA and Skylar Diggins is one pass away. And that's just the bit. Like they can just flow into that. The movement sets that they can run with those three is just really fun. So fun start to the preseason. Hopefully it rolls on.
Yeah, there you go. Just to quickly add on the Storm front. Had a lot of fun with the Chris Paul, Blake Griffin-esque, like let's post up Skylar, then flow into this super low pick and roll. Let's see what you do with it. Like watching them sprinkle that in and Skylar getting downhill. Then she got to a floater once and then she hit Dulce for a layup as well. It's like, they can just do that in addition to Skylar and Jewel and Neck all in action together. So that was fun. And that Seattle defense, man, so many traps. I felt so bad for the Sparks guard room in the first half. I was like, dog, they can't get into their offense. They are getting pressured at half court. And they try to go into any kind of pick and roll, whether it's a real one or let me set this and then float to the other side. And it's just pressure on the pass. Then there's pressure on the catch. And then they rotate behind that. That Storm defense is going to be fun. I am ready to see that Storm defense. And this is with Ezzie Mattbegor. She hasn't played yet. Like she's in camp now, but hasn't played yet. You add Ezzie to the mix as well. That defense is going to be nasty. And then very, very quickly. I'm glad you brought the Lynx thing. Courtney Williams is just going to lead all guards and screen set, and it's going to be a bunch of fun. Her and Nafisa Collier are going to have a really fun partnership offensively. And with the Sky, I have my eyes on the Rooks. Go ahead.
No. I was just bracing myself.
Not going to go too deep in the bag. I would just say Camila Cardoso enjoyed her defense. And it didn't lead to baskets in this first preseason game. And we'll just see how it evolves as the year goes on. But she chews up so much space. I appreciate how hard she runs in transition. It's not like she didn't do it at South Carolina, but like watching that pop in a preseason game, it's like, oh, she's just going to be able to get some easy ones if they look for her. Chew up space, quick seal, and then get out of there if I don't get the ball. Like she just had a really good court sense about her. As far as Angel Reese is concerned, like I appreciate the mobility defensively. Five offensive rebounds, I believe, in that first game. And she high-pointed a couple of those in the second half. I was like, oh, yeah, this is going to translate. She's going to be one of the best rebounders in the W. I will say, similar to like how much I appreciated Evan Mobley, you made the joke before the show. I need Elizabeth Williams to get Angel Reese in a room for an hour or two a day and say, we are just going to work on screens. We are going to screen. We're going to flip angles. We're going to work on our stance, our plants, footwork coming out of screens. We're going to make sure that we get contact. I did not enjoy the screening portion from Angel. I think that's something that could really improve. I don't think that's not a big red flag or anything like that. But it did stand out as they were working with her in pick and roll or her setting off ball stuff. Like, she just was getting out of there. And I don't think they have. It's not like she has like elite guard that just draws two and she can and those slips can be more impactful. She has to help her guards get open. So little room for improvement there. But yeah, I'm excited to see more. Certainly excited to see more. Plan on being in Columbia for the Aces preseason game over the weekend. So that should be cool. And we got more preseason action coming early in the week. So that should be a good time. What's up?
Did you see Pat Riley's quote on Jimmy Butler?
About him, you know, if you're not on the court, you should probably shut your mouth or something to that effect.
Yeah. Thoughts?
Yeah, that's... That's one of those where I've only seen the quote. I haven't heard the video. That sounds a whole lot harsher than maybe it was. Just as someone that's like listened to a bunch of Riley end of year pressers in my day. So it could just very, very much like tongue in cheek. Could just be like a little flippant thing. Like we have seen, like, you know, famously in 2014 when he hit LeBron with the if you have the guts. Like it can't just be static for sure. So like that's one of those things I want to hear before I have a firm opinion on. But
I have a question.
What's up?
Another question. Is it concerning that everyone's just picking the Knicks over the Pacers? I guess concerning might be the wrong word, but is it interesting that...
I am kind of surprised that I haven't even heard like the stray Pacers in six, Pacers in seven. Like, it just feels like, I feel like we did a good job of, like, talking about both sides, and I think we both landed on New York. But it just feels like a bunch of Pacers going to get beat up, Knicks in four or five. And I'm just like, well, even if the Knicks win in five, like, I don't think it's going to be they just blast Indiana. Like, they do deserve a little bit more respect.
Can I do a thing I don't usually do or I'm not supposed to do?
Sure.
We're recording on Monday, so tomorrow I'll either be right or wrong. I think this feels like a Tyrese Halliburton returns to form shooting-wise and the Pacers steal game one type beat.
Oh. I like the prediction. We will see how it is received based on what happens later tonight. Do you have any closing thoughts or free throws or anything?
No, mon ami. Let's get out of here.
All righty then. Well, thank you for listening to or watching this episode of The Dunker Spot. If you haven't already, please subscribe to us. We are on Apple, Spotify, RIP Google, Stitcher, Podbean, wherever you get your podcasts, you can find us. If you are watching us on the YouTube channel of JJ Redick and you haven't subscribed for some reason, please subscribe to JJ's channel. We are on the channel every Tuesday. That's the day after Monday, the day before Wednesday. But there's also just great content going on the channel throughout the week. We got some new friends joined the channel as well. The Road Tripping Crew hopping on. Subscribe if you haven't already. You can follow me on Twitter at NikaiasNBA. You can follow Steve on Twitter at SteveJones20. Join the Dunker Spot community if you haven't already on Twitter. If you want to watch some playoff games with us, get some in-game breakdowns, join us for our Dunker Spot online watch parties. The link is in your description. Free to create a profile. Come rock with us. Again, we're breaking things down during commercial breaks, during halftime, and in general, it's just a cool community of folks that love basketball. So if you want to chop it up with us, you can. We're live just about every night. Naturally, we're recording on Monday, so we'll be live for those Monday games. The Tuesday night games, we'll be live for those as well. We'll be live for all the playoff games. So if you want to watch, click the link, set up your profile, come rock with us. And with that, we will catch y'all later in the week.
Hey, Nikias, great show. Yeah, Richard Jefferson does not know we exist. Sorry, big dog.